Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Saturday morning Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 13th, 2019. This is the 13th week of our Tuesday, 2019 Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Dukkha Sutta. In this sutta, the Venerable Sariputta teaches Jambudvipika a simple, direct, and useful understanding of the three forms of dukkha. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. We have a Mary convention online. The two Marys have joined us. Welcome, Marys. I'll unmute your mics in a little bit, but you can do so if you have anything you want to say. I think we're in the 13th week of our Saturday Truth of Happiness Dhamma study. This is the third week on the three marks of existence. And today's sutta is on the Dukkha Sutta, a very short sutta given by Sariputta to Jambudvipika, the wanderer. I think I'll call him Jambi for short from now on. There's a lot of significance even in that. You would think that a sutta that is called the Dukkha Sutta, kind of the whole point of the Dhamma, would be presented by the Buddha rather than Sariputta, one of his senior monks. But the three marks of existence are either inferred or directly referenced in nearly every sutta the Buddha gave. There was really no need for this, a specific sutta on dukkha from the Buddha. But the question from Jambi is, an important sutta, in that Sariputta presents these three forms of stress that are directly correlated to the three marks of existence. Lorna pointed that out too, that the Buddha, the brilliance of the Buddha is that he took this incredibly broad and all-inclusive understanding of the human condition and human life in its environment, but was able to focus it and boil it all down to these simple three elements, the three forms of stress, which, as you'll see, they relate directly to the only useful insight the Buddha taught, which is insight into these three marks, because they're all kind of the same thing. Something else I want to say about that. Just to clarify how this connects, the Buddha described dukkha in very simple terms. He said dukkha is a broad term, Pali term, which in itself is, might take some explanation one of these days. I'll talk about the difference. But Pali, like most of the Prakrit languages, including Sanskrit, is a language that is inflective, and the only way you can truly understand it is to understand what is the underlying inference. In other words, you have to understand the context in which these talks are given. And the reason why Pali is the language is that was the written language. Pali was not a language that I don't think anybody ever really spoke. It's simply a literary language. But it's closest to the Prakrit that the Buddha taught, at least that's what scholars say. So that's why the translations that are most useful are translated from the Pali rather than something else. So the Buddha described dukkha as birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering. Not getting what is desired is suffering. Receiving what is undesired is suffering. And then he would always close that by saying, in short, the five clinging aggregates are suffering. And we're going to touch on that in a few weeks, so I won't get into the five clinging aggregates, except to say that's the Buddha's description of the ongoing personal experience of suffering rooted in ignorance. Five clinging aggregates. So these three elements that I'll get to in just a moment are part of that experience. In other words, they contribute to the stress of birth, sickness, aging, and death, etc., etc. Because we don't understand it and we react to these three. Okay, let me get to it. On one occasion, Venerable Sariputta was in the Laka. The wanderer, Jambudvipika, approached with a question. Wise friend, when speaking of stress or dukkha, which forms of stress are referred to? Friend Jambi, there are these three forms of stress: the stress of pain, the stress of fabrications, and the stress of change. So the first is obviously referring to dukkha, suffering, pain, stress, disappointment. The second, the stress of fabrications, as we've learned, it's because of creating a fabricated view rooted in ignorance. Dependent origination starts with from ignorance through from fabrications are rooted in ignorance, from ignorance to 12 observable causative links, all manner of suffering arises. It's from creating a fabricated or corrupt view of ourselves in relation to the world around us that leads to that pain that is just mentioned. And those fabrications are what we are compelled to maintain if we're compelled to maintain wrong views. Maintain this thing called anatta, not self. So the Buddha's use of the term anatta is important because it was a common term of the Buddha's time that is misinterpreted today because of lacking the context. In other words, we're still using, many modern Buddhists still use the definition of anatta prior to the Buddha's use of the words and maintaining that level of ignorance. The Buddha used the term anatta, again a common term, to simply say that the views you are holding of yourself are fabricated. They're corrupted views. Let go of the views. Meaning, and so those views do not constitute a self. They're not a self. That relates to anatta. And the stress of change simply refers to impermanence. So do you see how the three marks of existence are included in these three stresses, and these only three stresses? You can boil down all suffering to these three expressions of suffering. These are the three forms of stress. Wise teacher, is there a path, a practice for the full understanding of these three forms of stress? Yes, there is a path, a practice for developing full understanding of these three forms of stress. The path is precisely this noble eightfold path: right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right meditation. Again, remember the context. And this is Buddha teaching someone who has a general understanding now of the Buddha's Dhamma. And if he wouldn't, be able to frame this question correctly. And Sariputta gets right to the point. If you want to understand stress, understand the first noble truth, you'll develop the fourth noble truth, the Eightfold Path. And he doesn't waver. He doesn't tell Jambukadika you need to do anything else or engage in endless different meditation practices or any type of rituals. He says if you want to understand stress, develop the Eightfold Path. Like the Buddha, Sariputta never minced words, never wasted any words. Sariputta has just described the Eightfold Path, and he says, this, friend, Jambukadika, is the path, the practice for developing full understanding of these three forms of stress. This path is an auspicious path, remember the Bhadakarata Sutta, an auspicious practice for the full understanding of abandonment of reacting to these three forms of stress, and the development of moment-by-moment refined mindfulness. That's a complete description of what we can expect through Dhamma practice. Jump ahead just a little bit. Yes, I thought that was the end. I just wanted to make sure. That is the end of the sutta. And isn't it just remarkable in its simplicity, but it's so reflective of the Buddha's Dhamma. It covers everything in that short sutta. It covers the three marks of existence, the personal experience of suffering, and the path out of this. This is all that we are concerned with in the Buddha's Dhamma. We're not concerned with anything magical or mystical or hidden. We're not concerned with appeasing or appealing to gods or divas. We're not concerned about what the future may bring, meaning a future life or even tomorrow. We understand that this is the practice. That's all. Let's just go around the room and see how you feel. Let me start with our online friends. And I think Mary joined first, so we'll go to Mary first. I can't. Let me see. Wait. No, that's not it. All right.
Hi, John.
Hi, Mary. How are you?
I'm good. I'm back from my travels, so happy to hear your voice.
Thank you.
The simplicity is lovely. The conciseness is really fascinating. I'm going to have to listen to it again. So thank you for doing this, and good morning to everyone.
Good morning, Mary. Glad you could join us. Mary, the other Mary, do you want to unmute your mic and say hello? Let me see if I need to do it.
All right, I figured out how to do it. All right.
Good morning, Mary. Good morning, Mary.
I'm technology challenged. Yeah, that was great. Short and sweet. You can't beat it. He just doesn't waste any breath at all.
Yep.
He just comes right to the point and just take it away and think about it.
Yep. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, all that we need to do in the Dhamma is to understand these three forms of stressfulness so that we can put them aside. So, glad you could join us, Mary. Jen, good to see you this morning.
Good to see you. Suffering occurs because Anatta interprets phenomena that arise and pass away, ordinary phenomena that arise and pass away, as personal.
Yes.
And
self-identifies, joins with it.
That causes suffering. That causes it. So, that's the interplay of the three marks.
Yes.
And that is also the first noble truth.
Yep.
All three of those are kind of addressed in the first noble truth. Dukkha occurs, but you're not just saying, when you say dukkha occurs in the first noble truth, you're not just saying the dukkha part of the three marks of the existence. You're saying dukkha occurs because anatta is interpreting impermanence as something negative or positive.
Yes.
Bad.
Yep.
Judged somehow.
Yep, exactly. And it's because of that. Again, dukkha is the broad term that includes
also
impermanence
means,
and not self that's within
dukkha.
It.
Yeah.
And the internal elements of impermanence and a misunderstanding of self, the not self characteristic, is what contributes to suffering, to dukkha. So in the Buddha's description of dukkha, birth, etc., describes the experience of suffering, and then the understanding of the underlying elements help us to recognize it and abandon it, our part in it. Kind of like any physical disease or even a mental disease, there's a lot of different components that we can get to, poor nutrition, smoking too much, whatever it might be. They're contributing to the illness,
mm-hmm.
but they describe the illness too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the same way. In other words, I smoked myself into emphysema. I fabricated myself into suffering. Nobody suffered by emphysema. That could be a little harsh.
But that's exactly it. I'm not seeing how you can have dukkha without anatta.
You can't.
Right.
Yeah. And once you and an understanding of self
mm-hmm.
cannot create suffering.
Right.
Again, you're seeing, you understand the tight focus of the broad Dhamma. This is it. In other words, it covers everything and gets us to look at things, our whole life and our environment in a completely realistic way so we can understand
mm-hmm.
these underlying
mm-hmm.
three stresses. And it really is that simple. And how do we recognize and abandon our contribution to stress? Yeah. Concerns me that nobody else had that answer.
I was going to say, this is not me, this is not mine. It's myself, because that's always the answer.
But that is, and how do we get that? Through the Eightfold Path.
Right,
thank you, Jen. Good morning. Good morning, Lorna.
Morning, John.
Well, I just thought what Jen just said was brilliant.
I do too.
It was just everything.
Yep.
It was brilliant. It really was, Jen. Oh. It was brilliant. Thank you. Well, you would.
You're looking at a future teacher.
Now you're kidding.
I know. I was thinking this week in my own practice that I can see that as we go about our day-to-day lives, we try not to get caught up in phenomena, which is what Jen just said. And bearing in mind that the teaching of this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am, those two teachings kind of like at some point merge together because they're about the same subject.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And although you teach it from this angle and you teach it, but at some point of understanding, it becomes the same understanding. And then this week we've had our first photograph of a black hole.
Yeah, that was remarkable.
Which was really something. And whenever I think of outer space and stuff like that, that you think of maybe standing on the moon and looking back at the Earth or something, and when it's lit up by the daylight, by the sunshine, it's turning. That's scientifically proof of impermanence to me.
Yeah.
And I just thought about when they were talking about the black hole and these millions of miles and stuff that you can hardly wrap your head around, that if we are on the planet Earth, everything is impermanent.
Yeah.
On that planet, everything is impermanent.
Yeah.
That's it. So that's all I have to say.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. If we're in the universe,
mm-hmm.
we know at some point everything's going to come to an end. That knowing in a situation when stress feels like it's arising and reminding ourselves, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not what I am or who I am,
mm-hmm.
is a direct application of the Dhamma. That's how it's to be practiced. Because what you're doing when you're saying that in a stressful or previously stressful situation is disjoining or disentangling from suffering in a direct way. And it's the most powerful thing we can do. The Buddha teaches that the problem is, and I get a little bit more into this in next week's Thursday talk on the Pallivaga, we join with our suffering. It's another word for attachment or clinging, because we take things that bother us personally. Whenever we personalize anything, that means that we've now joined with it. We've identified with it. We're saying, this is me. And reminding ourselves that this is not me directly cuts that. It cuts it off at the root. And that's why it's not just a powerful part of practice, it is the practice. To not attach ourselves to anything that is impermanent. Why? Because how could it be you? And it can only cause stress. Anthony, good to see you this morning.
Good morning. Glad to be here. I was wondering where change fits in. Change was the third one?
Oh, yep. Yeah.
Impermanence, yeah.
Yeah, which is another way of saying impermanence, because then I thought, well, that's a fabrication to think that everything should be permanent, so why not only have two?
Oh, because we don't... Because of our fabricated views... We may understand on a intellectual level that, of course, all things are permanent, but we attempt to, because of a fabricated view, establish a permanent self within an entirely impermanent environment. And that's really what causes stress. Because when I do that, when I decide this is me and it's rooted in permanence, and stress change naturally occurs because it has to, I react to it. Because I have taken it personal. Do you understand?
Yeah.
And so it's the insistence that whatever my views are of myself in relation to the world must remain the same because they're fabricated, that I create constant stress. And there's an underlying stress that's there because there's a part of us that knows that we're playing a game with ourselves, and it can't be maintained unless there's constant vigilance on self. What does that mean? Constant vigilance on self is self-centeredness, isn't it? It's conceit. It's always trying to promote and defend me in all situations. And when you look at all the conflicts in the world, they can be boiled down to that one element, me getting what I think I need or what I think I'm right about. And everything changes. And on a broader scale, it helps us to understand that as a global species, we're all in a state of constant flux, including our social systems that are always evolving to reflect the state of the thinking behind that. And look what's going on in our country. It's just that. And we've polarized those ideological views, and now we're just clashing because we're simply not accepting reasonable change within a reasonable debate. And that's why, you know, you could say things are really going to heck, aren't they? Because of that. It's just a misunderstanding. So change is a constant, including what this is. So when we understand that, and we start deepening our understanding of what a human being, what a person is, and refer it back to the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, and understand we are just simply these six properties. The four: earth, wind, fire, and water, the space property, and the consciousness property. That's all. Every human being is that. And look at each of those properties. They're all always change. And so when we try to embellish that or attach anything to those things, it simply doesn't work, even though in our minds we want to maintain it. Change occurs. An awakened human being is simply present, mindfully present, without any reaction, and is in that stream of constant change without the need for it to be any different.
Yeah. I find it helpful for myself to look at the third person. So if I say that person's making me upset, say, all right, there's the person making me upset, there's the person upset, and then there's the person noticing the person is upset. So how could I be upset if I'm noticing the person who's being upset?
Yeah, and understand that there's nothing there to take personal. It's because there really isn't. Again, no matter how much we want to be something other or more than these six properties, we can't. And everything else that we insist we are is simply embellishment, correct? I mean, we could say, well, I'm six properties, and I'm the president of the United States. Well, you're still just six properties, and that's certainly an impermanent position, isn't it? But anything, I'm six properties, but I'm also Seward Johnson. I'm one of the richest men in the world. He's passed now, or I'm Jeff Bezos. Well, Jeff Bezos is still six properties, and this is what's going on in his life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't define him in any way. I mean, some people might be enamored by wealth or position, even if we are. You know, the Queen of England is six properties. Mickey Mantle was just six properties. What he did with his life is somewhat remarkable if you're into sports, but if you're not, he's completely insignificant, isn't he? And that's the way it should be. It's not. That's just the way life is. So what's important then? If we can't be anything more than an embellished six properties, what's the most important thing? What's the most valuable thing to acquire?
To not let the notion of the six properties get out of sight and think that you're too big for yourself.
Yeah, that's right. The most important thing then is to understand six properties. That this is what I am. And you can say, when you're looking at the earth property, then you can say, well, this is me. But why is that significant? Because the earth property is impermanent. The fire property is impermanent. The wind property is impermanent. The water property is impermanent. The space property is impermanent. And the consciousness property is impermanent, isn't it? And we're talking about ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths until it's awakened. It's all impermanent. And there's nothing we can do to change that except when we do, when we insist that I am a permanent self that's going to, I mean, some religions teach that you just simply live forever as this being. You're creating such tremendous stress because of that fabricated view.
Mm, yes.
Well, I'm sorry, were you done?
That yes, I'm done.
Great.
Thanks.
Yeah, great subject to bring up. Thank you. Becky, good to see you.
It's good to be here. Wow, I just have so much to think about. I don't even know if I can really say anything.
It's just short suit, then, huh?
Yeah. I guess where I really get confused is I can kind of... If you're... Where do you go from there? I mean, if you're just these six properties and... You know, I don't know. I just don't know where to go from there. Do you know what I mean by that?
How is that a useful
saying,
teaching?
Yeah, you're saying you're just living your life moment to moment. Mm-hmm. And that's where you go from there, is to just living your life moment to moment. Not that that's bad. I mean, if you're just six properties...
How do you establish yourself in the world?
Yeah, what do you do?
Look, common question.
Exactly.
Yes, that is. That's the heart of the matter. That's why many, many people run from the Buddha's Dhamma to something else, because that feels like annihilation, doesn't it?
You don't establish yourself in the world. That's
the problem is that I insist of establishing myself from a fabricated view in the world, and that creates stress. What does it look like when you understand? What would your life look like when you completely understand the Dhamma? People couldn't tell the difference. Your situation likely wouldn't change. You might simplify your life or something. Maybe most people tend to move in that direction.
I would just have less stress.
Yes. And isn't that worth the price of admission?
Absolutely.
In fact, it's not that you would have less stress. When you fully develop the path, you'll have no stress.
No stress.
And again, the significance of that, and you've heard me say this often, the Buddha could have nearly as accurately described the First Noble Truth as saying there is distraction, as opposed to saying there is dukkha, because it's the preoccupation with stress and suffering that takes us out of the moment and has us live a life completely disjoined from our own life, because we're always chasing after what gives us pleasure, and consciously or subconsciously, sometimes to the point of conscious anxiety, hoping to avoid anything that brings us disappointment. I mean, that's a description of, at its most extreme level, of pathological anxiety, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And so it's that preoccupation with maintaining fabricated views that creates all the stress in the world. And it's the fabricated views that insist on establishing me in a way that I think I must be established. Outwardly, it might be just the same. King Ashoka, I always use him because he's such a good example, was one of the most bloodthirsty rulers the world has ever seen. He took to the Dhamma and awakened and changed in such a profound way that he started universal health care 2,300 years ago. We still haven't figured out how to do it. He started universal veterinarian care, but he still was King Ashoka, wasn't he? And from people that really didn't know him, except weren't getting their heads cut off by him, wouldn't know the difference. But he did. He lived the rest of his life doing what he needed to do as a ruler, but he lived it with a calm and peaceful mind. And the same is true. So we don't lose anything. In fact, the only thing we lose is the opportunity to inflict confusion, deluded thinking, and suffering on ourselves. That's all. That's all we're abandoning. So a great point you bring up. Do you see that a little bit more clearly, though, Becky?
I do now, yes. Okay. I see it.
Can I?
Every once in a while, I can just grab onto it, but then it's so hard to keep it.
I was going to ask you, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, and you just kind of developed this insight, but could you explain your understanding that you just got, or you need a little time to mull it over?
I can say that just thinking of yourself as these six, or however many.
Six properties.
Elements, six elements. And sort of abandoning your ego, or that it is what all you're really doing when you do that is taking the stress that's caused in your mind only. It's only in your mind.
Yep.
It's only here. It's not out there.
Yep.
It's here. And what you're doing is you're just realizing that that's where it is and stopping it. And
yeah,
not
stop, that's it.
Not doing it anymore. Not doing it. And that's profound right view.
It is.
To, you know.
That's exactly it. It's seeing things as they really are, meaning we don't take it personal anymore. It's just what's occurring.
And it doesn't matter what it is.
Doesn't
you
matter.
You should be able, if you're really a good dog, you should, not you should be able, but what will happen is you won't take anything personal. You'll just look at it, this is what's happening now. I mean, and you can be sad by it. You can still have emotions. It can make you sad.
Yeah.
It can make you... But what it doesn't do, you just have a pure emotion. It doesn't cause you to grip on and say, I have to do something to make this better.
Yeah.
Is that right?
That's exactly right. And the again, to some people will say, well, that just sounds like you're completely detached from the world.
Yes,
but the
I
opposite,
thought that too.
But
yeah.
The opposite is true, because you are so mindfully present. And remember, we don't not become a human being. We become a realistic human being. And a human being has feelings that from an awakened state do not promote more aggression or anger or frustration. They simply guide what's appropriate. Even the Vitakka Santana Sutta, the Buddha teaches, you gain the ability to think what we want to think when we want to think it, meaning when it's appropriate. And so when it's appropriate to be sad, we'll be sad. Because why? Because we're mindfully present human beings. When the Buddha heard that his dad was dying 140 miles away, you know, he couldn't get into an SUV and go there, he had to walk, he got up and walked 140 miles to be with his dad when he passed, with the hope that he could give him a little bit more Dhamma, get there before he passed. He didn't just disregard what was going on in his life. He was deeply involved, and he was deeply involved in a remarkable way. He didn't discriminate between anybody. In other words, people that usually rise to a certain level of power or prestige tend to only want to deal with people on that level. The Buddha went against all the conventions of his time. There's still a caste system in India, but it was much more severe then. And he never... it was never prejudiced against anyone. He was open and free with every other human being because he didn't see any distinction in himself or other people. He was simply this guy teaching the Dhamma. And we all do that. And I think probably you're all doing that in your own life as you develop the Dhamma. You're not taking what you do as personal, as serious. And I've heard from so many people, you're simply more effective. Anthony would be a good one to ask this too, because he's such
I actually have a great example I was thinking of. And I'm doing a seminar in a couple of weeks for the State Bar on how to be passionate in your career. And I was thinking, I had this case, and this particular insurance carrier is very difficult, and they offer $5,000 for cases they should offer, you know, 10 times the amount of money on. And I had one of those cases that they were going to make that kind of an offer on. And my client was a minority, so they tend to be more punishing of minorities. So I said, all right, you know what? I just found a way to enjoy every moment of what I was doing to build this case together, knowing I was going to bring it through a trial probably, even though there was a low insurance policy and it would be a lot more work and I wouldn't be making probably a lot of money if you factored in per hour of the work I put in. But I spent all the time meeting with his family, trying to figure out who my good witnesses would be, getting to know his children, getting to know him. Getting 150 transcripts on the defense expert to try to see where I could put together his medical opinions and how I can undermine them in this case. And I was trying to, and I was looking at it as sort of pride in building the best possible case I could.
Yeah.
And not looking at, Jesus Christ, this case should have settled. I'm not making money on this. This is aggravating. And then in the end, and I put every doctor on tape to prepare for trial, spend a ton of money. But in the end, they paid me the insurance policy.
Oh.
And that was nice. But if it went through trial, that would have been nice too. And so I guess what I'm saying is, I wasn't putting the brakes on through the trial process. I was trying to find joy in every moment.
Yeah.
And the relationships I built with that client and his family were amazing. And I was actually a little upset that I couldn't go through the trial. So that's my story.
Thank you. And it's just that way. Even something that was in the past completely adversarial from beginning to end. Yep. Even though you might win at the end, the satisfaction would be completely different, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Because you didn't get it until the end. You missed, in other words, maybe 2 years of your life to get to something that you could say is satisfying to me rather than not taking the process personal and enjoy every moment of it. That's the difference. What a good example of it.
I have another
question.
This might be a little off the subject. So if you see someone and you can see that they are causing their own stress, and they are very unhappy, is that something that you should just say, well, this is happening now, and this is just what's happening, and I have to just, you know, accept this? And or is there anything that you can do about that?
That's a great question, and it's the answer is somewhat, sorry, depends on the circumstances. From understanding the Dhamma, we understand that suffering occurs as a consequence of having a human life, and we understand that from the Salatha Sutta, but the Dhamma itself, that as individuals we contribute or exacerbate our suffering based on what we hold in mind, our fabricated views. And from that understanding, we can understand where the other person suffering arises, rooted in their own ignorance. And we're all welcome to our ignorance. You know, and actually I would say that there's nothing wrong that somebody else is living their life and feeling the effects of their own ignorance. That's part of life. I understand that. I did it to myself. So what do we do with it when there's someone that we want to care about, or maybe the world at large? Because the world is suffering, isn't it? Well, first we understand that an awakened human being said, that's going to occur. Mm-hmm. And there's nothing personal, including me. Now, if I think that I'm a savior, if I take it personal,
right,
that I'm responsible for fixing this problem that is inherent in human life, mm-hmm, now I'm completely self-centered, aren't I? I'm working my will on a situation.
Yes.
But from my understanding, I can maintain a mindful presence, and if it's appropriate, to let someone know, if you'd like to talk, this is what I do in those situations. But remember that we had that little talk about hugging people without even asking.
Mm-hmm.
This is another situation. When I insist that I know what's better for your life and I start putting it on you, I'm creating stress for two people at least, aren't I?
Mm-hmm.
But if I ask the question, do you mind if I hug you? Or in this situation, would you like some help? Do you want to have a talk? You want to sit down and have a cup of tea? I started one of my students said, you gotta, I don't watch much TV, but he said, you gotta watch this one show. It's just all bodhisattvas, all the characters. And it's a show called New Amsterdam.
Really?
And it really is. It's just, I started watching. It's just a great show. And the head of the hospital, he's got this mantra. And it's wonderful. How can I help? And isn't that a wonderful way? I was thinking about it. I don't want to get too dramatic and take my inspiration from a TV show. But think about that. How can I help in this situation? From the refined mindfulness that I've developed in myself, how can I help?
Yeah.
But if I haven't developed that refined mindfulness, that question could lead to a lot of difficulties for other people and myself, couldn't it?
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
Because then I'm telling you what is best for you. And that happens all the time, doesn't it? Then I'm the savior. That's what we were talking about earlier, about how politics is now more religion than civil discourse, because we have prophets, saviors, and martyrs on both sides, and they're clashing. What a great question and a great explanation of it. Did that, again?
Thank you. That was very helpful.
Yeah, thank you. Great class. Kevin, good to see you.
Thank you. His teaching is deceptively simple. You just think, oh, okay, well, that's it. Okay. Sure. So you can see how much it generates when you really look into it and think about it.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, in regards to what Becky said too, though, I mean, and to the Dhamma, I think one of the purposes of the Dhamma is to become compassionate. And when you see someone is suffering, that compassion can, I think, can overwhelm us at times. It can really, it wells up in us. And I think it can be appropriate to just do as you said, to say, what can I do to help you? You know,
yeah.
I see you're hurting. Although some people would think they're not hurting, you're hurting them, or they're angry about something. So it is depending on the situation, but
yeah.
I think that compassion brings us to a moment where we want to help, and that's appropriate. And I think that the Eightfold Path engenders that.
Yeah, it absolutely does, and that's kind of the key. Thank you, Kevin. That you've heard me say it so often, the most loving thing I can do for all sentient beings is to take to the Dhamma and awaken. Because then as I'm living my life and I encounter the outside world or people suffering, I can approach it from a truly helpful and useful vantage point. And I can tell you that, you know, it's worked. In my interactions with people, I've been able to be helpful without interjecting an individual view on how they should be. It just is. And it's a way of living in the world free of entanglements and yet take great fulfillment. I mean, my life is so meaningful, much more so than when I was running a big successful business. And it's because of the true human connection. There was many more people that I interacted with back when I was busy and, you know, running 16 guys and doing this and that. But the relationship was, and I didn't have a hard relationship, so it was just a business relationship. There was no real connection to people. But here, I'm connected to each and every one of you, and online. And again, I hope I'm not overplaying this, but it's made my life so meaningful. The less entangled I am in the world, the more meaningful my life is. And it's just that way for everyone. The Buddha was the most compassionate human being that's ever lived. But he married it with a great wisdom of understanding. So he was effective during his time, but he's still effective right here today. Imagine having that kind of mindful presence. It is remarkable. Thank you. Nick, it's good to see you.
Good to see you. Okay. I have a question. So we had a very simple sutta.
Yep.
It was clear and covers everything. But would it be? But it's only effective if the person you're talking to understands the teachings of the Buddha.
No, I don't want to cut you off. I know you have more, but I'm going to stop you there. No, it's just as effective no matter what other people are doing. This isn't about changing other people at all. It's about changing ourselves, because that's the only change that we can take, and it relates directly to the three marks of existence. So as we develop the Dhamma and we develop that unwavering, calm and peaceful mind, it doesn't matter what's going on. It doesn't matter as far as our maintaining that peaceful mind to what other people are doing. Does that, it made me, by cutting you off, I didn't really, but that's
what... You cut me off, that was what I wanted to say.
Is that useful to you?
Yes, but it still begs the question, if the person that came and asked that question was not familiar with anything that the Buddha said, would the answer still be the same?
Yes. I mean, what is the question? How does suffering occur? Is that what you're referring to?
it's not that clear. Right?
I think what Nick might be saying is that how receptive is it to a person that's not open to receiving it?
Yes.
Oh, not it's not very, but that's not the point. Again, this is not, the Buddha is not teaching a salvific religion. He didn't present himself as a savior. So when dukkha arises in front of someone who doesn't need to save the world, they're simply maintaining a realistic, mindful presence. So in each situation, we develop the wisdom to discern. An aspect of right speech is to know, or at least have a pretty good idea, that what I'm about to say is going to be useful to the person I'm talking to, and that it will likely be engaged with in the way that I'm presenting it. Another way of saying that is, what I'm about to say, is it really necessary and will it be useful? Mm-hmm. And if it's not, we simply keep our mouth shut for all kinds of good reasons related to not creating more stress in my life and that person. If a person isn't ready to hear the Dhamma or show a real interest in it, they could listen to me forever and it's not going to mean anything because they're not ready to hear it. But again, there was a time in my life when I was the savior of the world. I think we all feel that way at certain times. When I understood what the Buddha was teaching and that my position was simply to awaken and present that mindful presence to the world, it frees you up from having to change anybody or even resolve difficulties in a way that are unrealistic by insisting that people be different than they are. It might seem cruel, but one of the reasons why I say the Buddha was the most compassionate human being is that he knew that any interaction that would further people's distraction towards ignorance was cruel. So he would only speak when he knew that something would be useful. Other times, there's many stories where people would come up with the Buddha with a really foolish question, and he just sat there. Just like that. Because as an example, that question does not deserve an answer. It's a foolish question.
He didn't say foolish, did he?
Oh yeah. Well, the translations, he uses that word often, foolish. It doesn't mean that people are fools. It means in relation to the Dhamma, your position is foolish. So not everybody's going to take to the Dhamma. They just won't. But again, the Buddha realized that, and so he didn't set himself up as savior or teach a salvific religion. Religion is responsible for saving people, isn't it? Mm-hmm. In the Buddha's Dhamma, we're responsible for, you could call, saving ourselves, but awakening. It's completely practical. It's very hard not to conflate, even, you know, in the somewhat subtle ways, what we're doing as some type of religion, but it's also important to recognize that it's not. Mm-hmm. It's not dependent on anything, and it's not compelling us to do anything except awaken within this framework of the Eightfold Path. The great power that comes from integrating the Eightfold Path, and I think some of you are experiencing this, when I realize that as long as my behavior is framed by the Eightfold Path, I don't have to worry about what I'm going to do next because I know I'm going to remain harmless. And that one thing relieves an awful lot of stress. I don't have to always be looking over my shoulder, but we have to develop it first. The Eightfold Path itself becomes the greatest by... I guess the paradox would be, by framing or integrating the Eightfold Path as the framework for our life, it opens our whole life up because we don't have to be concerned about anything because we're not taking anything personal. And so when the opportunity arises to be helpful towards people, we are. And when it's not, we aren't. And we understand the difference. Does that help,
yes.
Nick?
Yes.
Yeah. And so we hope that we can find systems we can use to manipulate the world. I mean, that's normal. That comes from a fabricated view. And one of the difficulties that people have with the Dhamma is we realize this is forcing us to throw away all of that, to not want to manipulate anybody because we stop manipulating our view of ourselves. We're simply at peace. Marvelous, isn't it? There's great peace in that. You know, and in that one thing, by understanding... We're coming to the end of these 3 weeks, understanding these three marks of existence and how a misunderstanding creates stress and suffering. Next week, we're going to start probably 2 weeks on dependent origination, the Paticca Samuppada Sutta. And then we're going to use that sutta next week. And then after those 2 weeks, sometimes it runs into three, it's a long sutta, we're going to look at the five clinging aggregates as part of this next chapter in the book. But there's a new sutta, not a new sutta, a sutta that I haven't applied yet. I'm saying it right. I taught the Anuradha Sutta about 6 months ago, and I'm going to use that when we get to the five clinging aggregates. And I think you'll find that useful. So, any other questions or comments? Our retreat's coming up. Please come if you can. I think it's 1 month from this week. So, thank you, Mary, for joining us. We'll finish as we always do with the Metta Sutta. So these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways. Peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class this morning. Thank you, Mary, for joining us.
Thank you, John.
Mary.
Peace.
Thank you, John.
The Marys. See you, Mary. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.